Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Teamsters on the move trying to organize an Amazon facility in Canada. A UAW in Michigan on strike. Liz Shuler speaking out on the California recall effort. And today on the show, The Nation on how students fought Harvard and won. And the latest from the North Coast Labor Federation. Welcome to the Thursday, September 16th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. We have two guests on the show today. We're going to start things off with Ilana Cohen. Ilana is a student at Harvard University, and she contributed to Nation Magazine. This is our segment we started a couple years ago. Nation Magazine, believe it or not, has been around since 1865. You think how many publications have come and gone since that time? Hard-hitting reporting. And like I said, she's a student, and she helped spearhead the fossil fuel divestment campaign on Harvard's campus, and she wrote all about it. The article is titled, How Students Pressured Harvard to Divest from Fossil Fuels and Won. We should also mention that The Nation was the first national publication to report on the student divestment drive at Harvard, and that started about 8 years ago. So this campaign had some legs to it, and we're going to talk about how it began, how she got involved in this, and what it means. And we should point out, for the world's richest university, I mean, their endowment, oh my gosh, it's in the billions and billions and billions. Harvard has a clear history of lagging its peers on pressing issues of social injustice, like divestment from apartheid South Africa. To finally embrace fossil fuel divestment, representing an incredible triumph for climate activists. We'll talk about the timeline and how they're going to hold their feet to the fire. The university caved, and it was a pretty much of a surprise to everybody. They were working on the campaign, and all of a sudden Harvard comes out and said, okay, we give in. We're done. So Ilana Cohen is going to talk about that in her article in The Nation magazine today. Pat Gallagher will be joining us later in the show on behalf of the steelworkers and the North Coast Labor Federation. One of the things he's going to touch on is something very important to Northeastern Ohio, especially Cleveland, Ohio, and that's the mayor's race. There was a primary election 2 days ago, and we had the two top candidates. We'll talk about labor's involvement there. For the bigger picture, we're going to get into Cleveland Cliffs. Sherrod Brown, Senator Sherrod Brown, toured their Toledo facility recently, and they just pumped in something like $1 billion to upgrade their plant. This is a long, long time company in Cleveland. I believe they go back like 140 years. And get this, you know what's going on with workers and unions and the vaccine. And there's some company, Delta for one, they told their employees that if you don't get the vaccine, your health care premiums would go up about $200 a month. Well, that's pretty much rattled the cage, and they're getting the vaccine because they don't want to pay the $200. Then there are companies that provide incentives to get the vaccine, like a day off from work, or maybe $100. How about this for Cleveland Cliffs? You get the vaccine, you get a $1,500 bonus. $1,500 bonus. Now, you get that bonus and you tell your coworkers that they too should get the vaccine. And if your unit gets up to, I believe, 75%, if 75% of the people get the vaccine, they doubled that to $3,000. What do you think? Pretty good, huh? So Pat's going to touch on that and more as our second guest right here on America's Workforce. The Teamsters, got to hand it to them. We had a show a couple weeks ago about what they're doing to organize Amazon. And let me just give you one example. This one comes out of Canada. Local 362 has filed an application with the Alberta Labor Relations Board to hold a vote to unionize workers at a facility, an Amazon facility in Nixu. That's a suburb of Edmonton. The facility employs between 600 and 800 workers who will be the first Canadian Amazon employees to hold a unionization vote. The Alberta Labor Relations Board must verify the application before a date is set, but the union expects a vote before the end of the year. National President Teamsters Francois Laporte said in a statement, Amazon won't change without a union, be it on job security, pace of work, discrimination, favoritism, or wages. The company has proven itself to be profoundly anti-worker. Now, keep in mind, different labor law in Canada. So this will be one to watch and compare it to what could happen in the United States if we had the PRO Act. In the meantime, here's what Amazon is doing. You might have caught this week. They are hiking their average starting wage to $18 an hour. And they plan to hire more than 125,000 warehouse and transportation workers in this country. They also said they would pay a sign-on bonus of $3,000 in some locations, and the hourly wage could go up to $22.50. The company is hiring to run the 100 logistics facilities it will launch this month in the United States, on top of the more than 250 that opened earlier this year. The staffing will also help roll out one-day delivery for Amazon's Prime Loyalty Club members. They're pretty slick in doing this. They know what's going on with workers trying to organize. So this is a pretty clever tactic on their behalf. Let's raise the wages now, saying, hey, what do you need a union for? You're already making $18, maybe $22 an hour. UAW reported that workers at ZF International in Marysville, Michigan, went on strike for recognition after the company reneged on a neutrality agreement to recognize a majority sign-up for their union. The manufacturer of auto parts has employed Stellantis LLC workers at the ZF International plant. Workers there have clearly indicated they expect to join the UAW as the current Stellantis workers who are members of the UAW move to other locations. The majority of the workers have signed up to join the union, but ZF did not accept voluntary recognition. James Harris is director of UAW Region 1. This is what he said. It is unconscionable that the company would choose to put workers through delay tactics and efforts to avoid the union when a majority of their employees have agreed to it. ZF must cease these union-busting tactics and honor their workforce's wishes by recognizing the employees' right to bargain at this site, which has been a union shop. He also pointed out it'd be easier for new union members to win recognition if we had the PRO Act. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. More than 200 workers at Every Action. That's a company that provides nonprofits with customer relationship management, donor management, and fundraising software tools. They have won voluntary recognition after a supermajority of the workers signed union membership cards. The new bargaining unit includes software engineers, product managers, members of the sales team, and other staffers. And Every Action members are now affiliated with the Communication Workers of America. Comment here from Gabby Weiss. digital content editor at Every Action. Gabby says, as workers at Every Action, we are committed to making the world a more just, inclusive, and democratic place through technology. Every Action is a leader in the progressive tech industry, and our union joins the growing movement of unionized tech companies that are ensuring their workers have a real voice on the job. You know, in most of those tech companies, they make pretty decent money. Not all of them. Some of them are working 70, 80 hours a week. Let's see. We have another one here. This is out of Las Vegas. Registered nurses at Mountain View Hospital in Las Vegas have overwhelmingly approved a new collective bargaining agreement with HCA Healthcare, which includes important new provisions for infectious disease control protections. National Nurses United, great union, was in charge here. Nicole Taylor is an RN at Mountain View, and she said, "We are pleased to have achieved additional health and safety protections that we have been pressing from HCA management. These protections are essential to ensure safer conditions at our hospital." The union said that under the new agreement, all patients suspected of being infected with COVID-19 will be treated the same as confirmed COVID-19 positive patients, which means nurses will be provided with the same level of protection for both suspected and confirmed cases. That's pretty significant. Pretty significant there. I'll tell you, National Nurses has done a really, really good job, especially HCA Healthcare. I mean, this is not what you call a union-friendly organization. Union members and families of union members made the difference in the California recall election. Liz Schuler, president of the AFL-CIO, issued a statement yesterday saying, "Governor Gavin Newsom can continue his work building a stronger, more prosperous California. However," Liz said, "it cannot be lost on any of us that this attempted power grab wasted time, money, and focus on an ultimately futile attempt to oust a popular and respected public servant. Rather than a race for meaningful change, the California recall election was a race to the bottom in search of the most anti-worker and anti-union candidate to replace Gavin Newsom. This week, we celebrated this victory, and today we get back to the real work at hand of rebuilding the economy for working people. With this distraction behind us, we can now turn our attention to electing pro-worker candidates to state, local, and federal office." Amen, Liz Schuler. And the money spent by taxpayers, now this doesn't include the political ads. That comes from their campaigns. It could top $300 million. $300 million. The cost to taxpayers because of that recall. Or attempted recall. Got to salute the unions here. With 68% of the votes, nearly 64% of voters rejected the effort, compared to 36% who supported it. The labor movement helped lead the no campaign on the ground in the state as Newsom pursues his agenda. More than 2,500 volunteer union members from across the country helped make over 1.3 million phone calls to union families. That's a lot. 2,500 volunteers from all around the country. All right, we have to break. When we come back, we're going to link up with a student at Harvard who made a significant change. That's coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America. Chris LaGrange here, host of UCOM Live with Chris LaGrange, news, talk, sports, and workforce politics, the fastest growing podcast on, in, and around the internet. Join us live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter with archives on UCOMLive.com. Our loud and colorful panelists bring you current events like no other. So follow and subscribe today wherever great podcasts are found.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. In fact, Melissa Cropper will be joining us next Tuesday on the show. Speaking of teachers, though, a little shout out to the Louisiana Federation of Teachers, an affiliate of the AFT. They donated 18 pallets of water to help union members affected by Hurricane Ida. AFT Secretary Treasurer Fred Ingram made the trip to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to help unload supplies and meet with members of the Louisiana Federation. He posted on Twitter, "A great day. There is hope because we are still here. Hang in there, Louisiana. Better days ahead." Just another example of the solidarity in organized labor. All right, let's go to line number one. Joining us is Ilana Cohen. Ilana is a student. She's a junior at Harvard University, and she's also a contributor to The Nation magazine. And she came up with a piece titled "How Students Pressured Harvard to Divest from Fossil Fuels and Won." This was a monumental campaign, and Ilana's here to talk about it. Ilana, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, talk to me about this. I take it you're a student activist. You got a very rich university. They have a heck of an endowment. I know that, billions and billions of dollars. And they've, for so many years, like many institutions, have been investing in fossil fuels. So, kind of walk me through what happened here. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main takeaway is, you know, the incredible victory that we saw at Harvard for community and student organizing. Harvard's move really vindicates the persistent pressure that has been sustained by students, faculty, alumni, staff, and community members alike on the institution in order to respond to demands that it take climate change and environmental injustice seriously. There's simply no way for any university really at this point in time to claim to care about the well-being of its community, the futures of its students, or the planet, and simultaneously invest in the very companies who are undermining climate policy, spreading climate misinformation, and refusing to align their business models with the goals of the Paris Agreement. And of course, this is particularly, you know, resonant at Harvard in particular, because it is the richest, it's the richest university, and it has an incredible amount of social prestige. And so if Harvard invests in fossil fuels, it sends a really awfully powerful signal that it's justifiable for other institutions to do the same. And finally, getting Harvard to reverse course sends the opposite signal, which is fantastic. And also, you know, getting this victory involved challenging the same kinds of entrenched power structures that enable the fossil fuel industry to exist in the first place. Part of our fight for divestment was really a fight to see greater democratization, which in many ways we're still waiting for. But, you know, even the most prestigious institutions are not immune to responsibility for meeting their community members' needs and demands. Certainly, they should actually be models for democratic and socially responsible and just decision-making practices. And the fight for that broader vision definitely still continues, but the win on fossil fuel divestment is an immense stride toward it.
Ilana, you're just a junior. Are you serious here? I mean, I can't believe the response you just gave me on this. You sound like a seasoned lawyer talking to me.
Oh, well, I appreciate it, but I am a junior, so they're stuck with me here for two more years, which is quite exciting to me. I'm not sure how others feel about it in the administration.
This is great. Really, really great here. Okay, now, do you have any idea how much of their portfolio, I'm talking about Harvard's investments here, was it heavy into fossil fuels, to your knowledge?
Yeah, so they actually announced earlier this year that the exposure of the endowment to fossil fuels had decreased to only 2%. Now, okay, on the one hand, you know, 2% of the endowment seems really small. It's also important to remember that Harvard has a $42 billion endowment. So, you know, 2% of that is, I think, about $840 million. It's not that, it's not a small number, but really the number is irrelevant because the act of investing in fossil fuels, again, seems to justify the continued existence of this industry, which, you know, fundamentally has to disappear. Its core business model has to disappear for us to make a just transition to a renewable energy economy on a timeline that aligns with climate science. And I think it's also important to recognize that, you know, that 2% figure, that hasn't always been true. Over about the last decade, Harvard's endowment's exposure to fossil fuels has seriously declined. And that is a testament to the prudence of fossil fuel divestment. Much as Harvard has claimed over the past years that in divesting is a risky move, I mean, its own practices just speak to the contrary. The fossil fuel industry is in decline, and Harvard's finally committing to divestment is a huge vindication of organizing, but it is also a vindication just, you know, of the reality that the fossil fuel era is not part of our futures, and the market is starting to shift in line with that reality.
Ilana, I have to ask you, did they indicate where they are going to put the money now? And we're hearing a whole lot about solar, you know, green energy. I mean, there's a lot of investment opportunities there. And we talk about this on the show quite often because the trades, the building trades that worked in various industries over the years that are connected to fossil fuels are in a transition right now going on. I'm just wondering, did they indicate where they may be going with this money?
They didn't. I mean, they have said that they also have a goal of investing in a green economy. It's completely unclear what exactly that entails, with aside from some very small details that they provided. So, you know, a big part of our work at Fossil Fuel Divest Harvard going forward is going to be really pushing for investment in sustainable, just, and equitable industries, and thinking about how the endowment can actually be used to accelerate the kind of just transition that we really need to see on a rapid timeline. But so that's a huge part of our work that really, you know, that we are going to be continuing to do, because we haven't gotten really meaningful or transparent commitments to investing in a just transition, which of course means accounting for impacted worker communities as well as frontline communities. We haven't gotten that commitment yet from Harvard.
It's interesting to note, too, because they kind of just announced this. Didn't they just come out and say, OK, we're done. We're not going to invest anymore. Is that simply how it came out?
Yeah. And they didn't even use the word divestment, which is a serious testament to their fear, their continued fear of alienating, per se, the fossil fuel industry. And, you know, again, that reflects these really entrenched power structures at Harvard that we're coming up against every time we fight for something like fossil fuel divestment or divestment from any fundamentally extractive and exploitative industry. The fossil fuel industry in particular has a very pervasive presence on Harvard's campus. You know, it funds research. Several of the members of the Harvard Corporation, Harvard's primary governing body, have ties, financial ties to the fossil fuel industry, which our campaign has detailed in our legal complaint to the Massachusetts Attorney General's office. And those ties persist. So another big part of our work is really trying to extinguish the industry's imprint on campus and to make clear that, you know, there's no way in which it's acceptable for Harvard to lend its social license to the fossil fuel industry.
Well, this was part of a movement. And Ilana, maybe you can give us some specifics on how large this movement. I mean, this was over the process of a number of years. And Harvard, we should point out in your article, points this out. They have a history of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I bring up the South Africa apartheid, and that took a while to divest from. But they're not alone. I mean, there's a big part of corporate America. Many universities in America were involved in the same kind of thing. But the size of the group, I mean, you're taking on a giant. I mean, Harvard's been around for centuries. And their policies have been in place for a long time. Their endowment's been in place for a long time. How many people were involved in this campaign?
Oh, my God. That is, it's too many to count, I have to tell you. It's so many. But, I mean, okay, so at the very least, you know, hundreds of students. This campaign has existed really since 2012. And, you know, there have been generations of students who've been at work at this. Also, faculty, so hundreds of faculty. We had some incredible pro-divestment votes from the Faculty of Arts and Sciences and at Harvard Medical School. Thousands of alumni, including some very prominent alumni like Al Gore. And then, of course, we've also had many staff members and community members who have been integral to this work and other divestment campaigns on campus. So, yeah, I mean, this was a massive, massive community effort. And it also, you know, is part and parcel of the broader divestment movement. We couldn't have won without, you know, being connected to so many other campaigns and learning from them, both specifically focused on fossil divestment and not focused on it, and from the work of, you know, generations of students past, like those who fought for apartheid divestment and right. tobacco divestment. So it's just it is in so many ways this victory a true testament to the power of persistent and collective organizing.
And Ilana, I'm also reading in your article, you also had some help from the Massachusetts Attorney General's office on this. I'd like to touch on that. And also, if you don't mind, I'm going to come back and do another segment with you. There had to be some pushback on this, and I'm thinking maybe threatened to be arrested, jailed for what you did. Let's get into that. Ilana Cohen joining us on our live line. She wrote a segment for The Nation magazine dealing with Harvard divesting from fossil fuels, how students pressured the university and won. We'll continue that conversation later in the show. Pat Gallagher will be joining us on behalf of the North Coast Labor Federation.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with prostate, breast, or any other cancer after taking Zantac? You may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at KellyAndFerraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialist, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit SurveyandBallotSystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on 5 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. When you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis. And give us a rating. 5-star ratings are always appreciated. Let's go back to our live line and rejoin Ilana Cohen. Ilana is a contributor to The Nation magazine. We do this segment each and every month, usually the third Thursday of the month. She's a student at Harvard. She's a junior, comes from Brooklyn, New York. And she is one of many who helped spearhead the fossil fuel divestment campaign on Harvard's campus. This has been going on for years, and we've been talking about how this materialized. I want to talk about the Massachusetts Attorney General. Apparently, you sought out their help, their office. How did that work? How did that come to fruition, Ilana?
Yeah, so earlier this year, we filed a legal complaint with the Mass AG's office, arguing effectively that Harvard's fossil fuel investments are not only immoral and financially reckless, but also illegal, and specifically illegal under a state law called the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, MIFA. A little bit of a mouth garble there, but a very important law because it exists in 49 states. So that's important to know, because what it implies is that, you know, under the arguments we're making, any university group or even perhaps like groups of folks who are at other nonprofit institutions can make the similar kinds of arguments to ours and file complaints of their own, basically saying that it doesn't align with nonprofit or charitable institutions' mission to invest in fossil fuels. I think for very obvious reasons, and reasons that are exceedingly clear at institutions of higher education, which are trying to prepare students for their futures. So we filed that complaint earlier this year. We've met with the Massachusetts Attorney General's office twice since then, and we've really appreciated how seriously they are taking our complaint. And this complaint also followed on the heels of students at Boston College is filing a complaint, which is really part of the inspiration for us. And they became inspired by similar moves from students at Cornell. So a really wonderful chain reaction of student organizing. Now we're also seeing a whole bunch of other student campaigns file complaints. And I think, you know, this complaint, the mere threat of legal action that it posed by the attorney general was very clearly pivotal in Harvard's decision to divest. I mean, you can see it in the exact language that Harvard President Larry Bacow used when making the divestment announcement. He called essentially fossil fuel investments imprudent. They'd be imprudent under this act that we invoked in our complaint. And he used language that very clearly mirrored the arguments that we have been making. You know, in terms of the state of the complaint, we are waiting to hear what the attorney general's decision is. Harvard does still have these indirect fossil fuel investments that it says it will phase out. We don't have a clear timeline for that. We don't know if they're going to be phased out on any sort of meaningful timeline in terms of what climate science demands. And those investments still, to our understanding, contravene state law. But again, I think the biggest takeaway here is that the impact of this complaint was so powerful that it really helped move, you know, the world's richest and one of its most intransigent universities to divest. So this is definitely a very promising tactic, I think, for other campaigns seeking fossil fuel divestment from their universities to look into.
So what you did with the Massachusetts AG's office was clearly a game changer. Yeah, when you're bringing lawyers in like that, I would imagine you're definitely getting their attention on this. Holding their feet to the fire, this is the interesting part, because they did not, just to be clear here, they didn't give you any timeline now, did they?
No, they did not.
Okay. Let me ask you this. This is very bold on your behalf, and you're doing such a great job on this show. What about any threats? Did that materialize in this campaign saying, hey, you know, you kids go back to school. What did you come to Harvard? You're spending all this money to learn something. Why are you messing around with the university? Did any of that happen?
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't characterize what we've received as threats, but certainly some hostility. And of course, I think what's most relevant, we've seen very, very concerted efforts by Harvard to shut down access of fossil fuel divestment supporters, which again are on campus really a majority of students and faculty, to decision making avenues at the university. You know, like every committee that exists that could have a voice in divestment, every board, every sort of space like that, you know, is just internally filled by the administration with people who are anti-divestment. They repeatedly over the years have cited the voices of a clear minority of anti-fossil fuel divestment faculty, and they've put those people in these sorts of positions. Just recently, Harvard named a vice provost for climate and sustainability who is an economist and has been one of the prominent anti-divestment voices on campus. And again, we know this is a minority of voices because we have things like landslide pro-divestment faculty votes that have happened in the last few years. After Harvard Forward, which is an allied organization of ours, successfully got three petition candidates onto Harvard's secondary governing board who were all pro-divestment, Harvard literally just changed the rules for getting on that secondary governing board to limit the number of petition candidates, which is like the only real democratic community route to getting these candidates on the board, who could be there in the first place. And then, of course, after we filed our legal complaint, Harvard completely shut down dialogue with us, even though that wasn't initiating a lawsuit. There's no legal reason they couldn't talk to us. They just thought, you know. So, again, I think what we've really seen is a very clear series of moves to marginalize the voices of folks who would express fossil fuel divestment support on campus, and efforts to ensure that they can't access any institutional power.
Mm-hmm. You know, it still amazes me on how quickly this changed. I mean, Harvard all of a sudden said, okay, we're not going to do anything. And they conceded to the student activists. Ilana, I have to ask you this. Other universities have portfolios that they invest in, and it could be fossil fuels. I don't know. I'm sure some of them are still in that category. I'm wondering, this movement, are you in touch with students at various universities? You mentioned Cornell before in a previous conversation. What's going on in that arena? Do you know anything?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're prominent, robust divestment campaigns of students, alumni, faculty, community members at so many schools nowadays. And we're in touch with quite a lot of them, in part because like one of our greatest goals at Fossil Fuel Divest Harvard is to collaborate with, working coalition with other campaigns, because that's how we build collective power. Ultimately, this is a movement that needs to touch every single one of our institutions. Several of the Ivy League universities have already made divestment commitments. At Princeton, there's sort of movement to get towards a commitment underway. There's been a committee that's been considering principles for investment, which would, entail divestment from fossil fuel companies that meet certain kinds of criteria. But certainly a lot of the big institutions are still lagging, like Princeton and Yale. Their commitments just absolutely are the commitments they're moving towards. With respect to each, just don't go far enough. And so students at both universities are really pressing on that. And of course, divestment, again, is so powerful because of the clear signal it sends that that investing in the fossil fuel industry is fundamentally unjustifiable. So this is really an issue for every institution, not just institutions with big endowments. And it's important to note that because there's so many incredible divestment campaigns at schools that have much smaller endowments, but the work that they're doing is equally as important.
Ilan, I've often said on this show the world is changing, and if you're not part of that change, you're going to be left out of the picture, no doubt about that. How students pressured Harvard to divest from fossil fuels and won is the title of the article, and it's in The Nation magazine. Ilana Cohen, a student activist at Harvard, is part of the campaign. I have to ask you, now you have contributed to The Nation before. How did that happen, getting this article in there?
Yeah. Well, when I went to my high school, which I'll give a little shout out to, actually, because it's pretty formative in my in the work I have done organizing for climate justice. It's called Beacon. It's a public high school in New York City. I ran the student newspaper, and one of our writers ended up knowing an editor from The Nation, Peter Rothberg, who came in and introduced himself to students and, you know, told us that The Nation actually accepted articles from students. And I remember that sitting with me and being like, wow, that's incredible. Like, there's a chance to write for The Nation. And then, you know, the next year I went to Harvard, started organizing around divestment, and realized that writing for The Nation was an incredible opportunity to shed light on these fundamental issues at Harvard that I was seeing in terms of its refusal to really recognize the clear moral imperative for divestment. And I wrote my first piece for The Nation shortly thereafter. It was called "It's Time to Shed Light on Our Elite Institutions' Dirty Money." And yeah, I've kept writing for them quite a bit since. The Nation is a really incredible publication. And one of the most incredible things about it is the forum it provides for students and for folks who might not conventionally have the same kind of access to mainstream media outlets to share the work that they're doing, and work that is really grounded in tackling structural injustices and inequalities.
You said it all. That's exactly why we do this segment on America's Workforce. Well, Ilana, thank you for joining us here on the show. You've been awesome. And I still can't get over the fact that you're a junior and she is studying philosophy and social studies. So you keep doing what you're doing. Finish your studies at Harvard. What's your plans after that? Any idea right now?
I hope to go to law school. I think it could just give me some really great tools for continuing the climate justice work that I'm doing now and that I have the privilege of doing with so many wonderful peers here at Harvard.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you. Please keep in touch with us. I love talking to bright individuals, and you're certainly in that category, all right?
Oh, I appreciate it. Well, I'd love to stay in touch.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Pat Gallagher will be joining us on behalf of the steelworkers and the North Coast Labor Federation. Interesting news about Cleveland Cliffs. He'll share that with us next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Sears Tower, and just about every building, bridge, and structure in between, our cities and towns wouldn't be the same without ironworkers. With over 3,000 contractors employing more than 130,000 highly trained ironworkers and 20,000 apprentices, the Ironworkers Union stands ready and able to shape the future of our skylines. Learn more at ironworkers.org. Ironworkers, the sky's the limit.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to AFLCIO.org.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared.
I feel like I'm choking.
Prevent your child's next asthma attack.
Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. Visit www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And of course, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And the Twitter handle is real simple, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number two. Welcome one of our regulars. Love talking to this guy, Mr. Pat Gallagher. On behalf of the North Coast Labor Federation and the steelworkers, you got lots of information to share with us today. And he is calling us from, what is it, Bryan, Ohio? Is that where
Bryan,
you are?
Bryan, Ohio, yes.
Okay,
yeah, we had
okay.
negotiations with one of our plants out here, local 7248, Wheeland Chase Brass, and came to a tentative agreement last night about 8:30. Get presented to the membership next week. So
good. I like to hear good news, especially when it comes to organizing and getting a new contract done. Good stuff. And there was some interesting stuff about Cleveland Cliffs, but let's talk locally first. There was a interesting mayoral race in Cleveland, Ohio this week, 2 days ago, and labor was involved. Maybe you can touch on that if you don't mind.
Well, I mean, a lot of unions made the endorsements in the primary. Steelworkers did not. We didn't make an endorsement because we had too many friends in the race.
Uh-huh.
You know, Dennis Kucinich has been, you know, was a great supporter of even the darkest days of steel industry in Cleveland. When during the LTV crisis, he was right there for us. State Senator Sandra Williams, she's been great to us, in the state Senate, and always been supportive of steelworkers. And actually, Kevin Kelly, as president of council, has been a great supporter, too. And we decided that we had too many friends in a race and didn't want to make any type of endorsement in the primary. But we're going to, we're getting with our local presidents now, and we're considering making an endorsement for the general election.
All right. And that's going to be in November.
And it was, the polling that we had seen before had Kevin Kelly, Dennis Kucinich, and Justin Bibb is the top three finishers. That was pretty universal in all the polls. They had them in different places. I've seen one where Dennis was ahead. I've seen one where Justin Bibb was ahead. So it was a very contested race and an interesting outcome. And hopefully we can elect a mayor that'll be take care of the city and steward it through these difficult times.
So it'll be Bibb against Kelly coming up in November. All right, let's move on to Sherrod Brown here. And I understand he was in Toledo the other day at Cleveland Cliffs. And we're talking about investing big time. What's the story there?
Well, it was September 2nd when Sherrod Brown toured the Cleveland Cliffs, a new HBI plant. HBI stands for hot briquetted iron. And this is a product that's used in steel making. It's a very versatile product that can be used as raw materials for electric arc furnace. It can also be used in the BOF, which is where the molten iron is actually made into steel. And it can be used in a blast furnace as raw material, too. And what it does, it eliminates the use of coke and other carbon and natural gas. That way, because it reduces the amount of carbon emissions, so it's a very environmentally sound product. And it's a future product that could help the steel industry continue to thrive in the United States. So it's a billion-dollar plant. That shows just Cleveland Cliffs' investment in American manufacturing. And Senator Brown was there to promote his Buy American provisions in the Infrastructure Act to make sure that we do pass an Infrastructure Act that it does contain Buy American provisions, because it's no good for our country in industry and manufacturing in America if we don't buy us the products that we make to rebuild our country.
Well, I got to hand it to the steelworkers because they've been on the campaign We Supply America, which we have done several shows on in the last couple of weeks. And that's been real successful here. Hopefully that message will transfer over to the lawmakers in Washington. How do you feel about that? That we got the bipartisan, I guess the bipartisan deal might be voted on. I'm hearing at the end of this month. You know anything on that?
Well, we're hoping that it's voted on and this gets passed. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of talk, and we think it's vital for the rebuilding of our country. And there's a lot of the opposition to the bill says, well, everything's okay. We're all recovering and everything's doing well. Business is doing well. But that's not true across the country. Actually, Congressman Marcy Kaptur is going to hold the event sometime next month in Lorain, Ohio, to show how these committees have been hurt by the loss of manufacturing jobs. And Lorain is a prime example of what can happen to a thriving industrial area when manufacturing is shut down, manufacturing leaves, because the devastation in Lorain, the city of Lorain, and actually the county of Lorain, is tremendous. I know I've said on the show today that Lorain makes Youngstown look like Beverly Hills right now, and that's exactly the fight that they're having out there. And we need to show that we need to have this investment. We need to restart some of these steel plants. We need to start some of these manufacturing plants to provide good paying jobs for Americans.
And there's a connection between those plants and our infrastructure, because, you know, the infrastructure is made up of steel, gravel, stone. I mean, we can make all these products right here in America, the electrical grid and water systems. Right. There's so much that needs to be done. And frankly, that's just a down payment, that $1 trillion package. All right. I want to switch back to Cleveland Cliffs. This is a historic company. Haven't they been around for like 150 years or something like that?
Yeah, they've been a mining company, and they actually were a shipping company for many years. They've been headquartered in Cleveland, and it's been a company has been downsized, been upsized, downsized. Now they're upsizing again, and they've been a very good employer. We've had a good working relationship with them, providing some good jobs for our members, and we've been had some organizing drives with them that we're working on now, and they've been taking a very neutral stance. So they've been a pretty good employer, pretty good partner for the United Steelworkers.
So talk to me about what they're doing to get workers vaccinated. This is kind of interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, we negotiated a vaccination incentive program with Cleveland Cliffs, and the program was totally voluntary, and it's an incentive for being vaccinated. We still believe, the steelworkers still believe, that vaccination is a personal decision, and it's up to you, and nobody should be mandated or forced to get a vaccination. But we negotiated this plan to try to incentivize people. And what we did was we got it negotiated a $1,500 payment for all those who are vaccinated. And if the location that you worked at, the plant or facility that you worked at, that reached the 75% of the bargaining unit was vaccinated, then they got another $1,500. So a total possible is $3,000 could be paid out to the membership.
$3,000 to get the vaccine.
Yep.
Actually,
in Toledo, Toledo, the HBI plant we just talked about, they 81%, and the Warren Coke plant reached 78%. So they're all going to receive the $3,000.
Now, are there plants that have not gotten up to that 75% right now?
Well, actually, the Cleveland works, we're probably sitting around 69-70% right now, and we're hoping that we can, you know, cross that line and get to that 75% level.
Yeah, I would imagine there would be some pressure among workers. Hey, get vaccinated! I want that $3,000. Come on!
Yeah, we're discouraging the peer pressure, but we believe that, you know, I mean, it's in everybody's best interest to be vaccinated, and hopefully we can get to that point where we get develop that herd immunity, and we can get past this pandemic and move forward. Right now, there's a big spike, a big surge in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. I haven't seen the numbers for yesterday, but I know on the 15th, it was 7,700 cases in Ohio, and the day before that, it was 5,500 plus. So we got a little spike in our area, and hopefully we can get through this, and I think vaccinations can help that.
Well, that's a heck of an incentive. $1,500 to get the shot, and then you get another $1,500 if your unit has 75% of the workers vaccinated. And that's all because of the United Steelworkers. I like that. You guys are good. You guys are really good. All right, my brother. You take care. Go back to your work in Bryan, Ohio. We'll check in with you next month, all right?
All right. Thanks, Les.
All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the latest from the American Legion and the Alliance for Retired Americans. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.